Welcome back to the deep dive. For months we've been talking a lot about the theory, right? The promise of decentralized
The whole
system.
philosophy behind it.
Exactly, the philosophy. But today we're kind of leaving that behind and moving into the messy reality of, well, of engineering. We're looking at the fundamental infrastructure, the plumbing.
It's a huge difference, isn't it? It's one thing to talk about what a system should be, but it's another thing entirely to actually build it, to make it work for, millions of users around the world securely.
That's the hard part. So our mission today is really to give you a clear roadmap for understanding the core constraints here. We want you to walk away knowing exactly why Bitcoin and Ethereum made the choices they did.
And why a chain like Solana took a completely different path.
Right.
And here's the thing, if you really get a handle on these trade-offs we're going to talk about, decentralization, security, scalability, you instantly see why layer twos even exist. They're the answer to this almost impossible engineering problem.
Okay, so let's start right there with that core challenge. It was coined by Vitalik Buterin, right? The blockchain trilemma.
That's the one.
And the idea is you have these three amazing properties, but a network can really only optimize for two of them at the same time. You can't have all three at full strength.
You just can't. You are forced to make a choice. And that choice, that prioritization, it defines everything about your project. You can go for decentralization and security.
Do you lose speed?
You lose speed. Or you can aim for speed and security, but you're probably going to sacrifice how many people can actually participate. It's a fundamental constraint.
Let's pin down what these terms actually mean because I feel like they get thrown around a lot. First up, decentralization. This is like the gold standard of crypto purity, isn't it?
It really is. It's the foundation for being trustless and censorship resistant. And we can define it pretty clearly.
Yeah.
It's about the number of independent nodes in the network.
So how many computers are running the software?
Exactly. If you only have 10 validators, it's pretty easy for an attacker or even the government to shut those down. But if you have 100,000 nodes, scattered across the globe, trying to control that becomes almost impossible.
Logistically and economically, yeah. Okay, next is security. This feels more like the financial moat around the castle.
That's a great way to put it. Security is really measured by how much it would cost to successfully attack the network. The big fear is always a 51% attack.
Where one person or group controls the majority of the network's power.
Right. And to stop that, you have to make an attack just ridiculously expensive. So expensive that it's economically irrational to even try.
And that's where things like proof of work's energy cost or proof of stake's massive capital requirements come in.
That's it. You raise the barrier so high that an attacker would lose more money than they could ever gain. It protects funds, it protects the data. It's crucial.
And finally, the one that everyone feels every day, scalability.
Scalability. This is just pure performance. We measure it in transactions per second, TPS, and also how fast those transactions are finalized. If you want to compete with something like Visa, you need thousands of TPS, not seven.
So scalability really determines how many users you can have and ultimately how low the transaction fees are.
Absolutely. So if we accept that every chain has to make a sacrifice on one of these three, then we can start looking at the big players as just fascinating case studies in trade-offs.
And those trade-offs tell you everything about what they value most.
Exactly.
So let's unpack that with the giants. Bitcoin and Ethereum, they've always been the security and decentralization maxes.
Oh, absolutely. They put that core idea of trustlessness above everything else. Their architecture is almost religiously designed so that every single node,
Even my laptop, if I wanted to run one.
even your laptop, has to process and verify every single transaction that has ever happened in order. That constant global double-checking is the source of all their strength.
Okay, that sounds incredibly secure. But if everyone has to check everyone else's work, what's the immediate, unavoidable consequence?
They are slow,
Ugh.
glacially slow.
By design. Bitcoin does what, maybe 7 transactions per second? Ethereum used to be around 15, maybe 30. I mean, compare that to a normal database, it's nothing. But their philosophy is clear. Better to be slow and trustless than fast and centralized.
Integrity over utility,
Sure.
in a way. So now let's flip that on its head and look at a scalability maxi.
Okay.
Solana. They came out of the gate talking about 65,000 TPS.
A completely different engineering approach. They built this thing called proof of history, or POH. You can think of it like a high-speed cryptographic clock.
So it's not replacing proof of stake, it's adding something to it.
Exactly. It creates this verifiable timeline, which lets the nodes process transactions in parallel instead of one after the other, like Bitcoin and Ethereum have to. And they use an engine called C-Level to make that parallelism happen. Okay, that sounds like a genius solution for speed, but we know the trilemma always gets its price. What did they have to give up for that throughput?
Well, they accepted a higher risk of centralization. To handle that fire hose of data, 65,000 transactions every second, you can't just run a validator on a normal computer.
No more laptop nodes.
No way. You need, like, a supercomputer, enterprise-grade hardware, tons of RAM, super-fast CPUs, crazy internet speeds. It's not for hobbyists.
Wait, hold on. If the hardware is that expensive, that must dramatically cut down the number of people who can even afford to participate, right? Doesn't that go against the very definition of decentralization we just talked about?
It's the core of the trade-off. By raising that barrier to entry, you are concentrating the power to validate the network into the hands of fewer, wealthier entities. Solana made a bet that achieving massive speed for consumer apps was worth accepting a more centralized network structure.
So we've pretty much established that this monolithic idea, one chain to rule them all, is basically dead because of the trilemma, which led the whole industry toward what's now called modular architecture.
It's just smart specialization, really. Instead of one network trying to be a bank, a court, and a video game platform all at once, you build specialized layers for each specific job.
Okay, let's start at the very bottom. Layer zero, the infrastructure and interoperability layer. This isn't even where transactions happen, is it?
No, not really. Think of L0 as the underlying highway system that connects all the different blockchains, which are like independent cities. Without it, they're all just isolated islands.
So it's about communication.
Communication and sometimes shared security. Polkadot is a great example, with its relay chain connecting all the parachains, or Cosmos and its IBC protocol, which is kind of like the TCP/IP for the crypto world.
Okay, moving up a level, we get to the slow, expensive, but authoritative layer. Layer one, the settlement layer. This is our Ethereum, our Bitcoin.
We call this the Supreme Court. It's slow, it's expensive, but its word is law. It's the ultimate anchor of trust. You don't go there for your morning coffee.
Right.
You go there to settle massive value or resolve a major dispute. Its job is to provide data availability, making sure the data is there for anyone to check, and consensus. It's the root of all trust in the system.
And finally, this brings us to the thing that actually solves the Steed problem. Layer two, the execution layer.
This is the express highway built on top of the congested L1 city streets. L2s are built for one thing. Speed.
Yeah.
They do all the heavy lifting of actually executing transactions fast and cheap. But, and this is key, they don't settle the books themselves. They just report a summary back down to layer one.
And that's the roll-up, right? That batching mechanism. Instead of every car paying a toll on the L1, they all get on one bus and just split the cost.
That's the perfect analogy.
Let's dig into that technology then, because roll-ups are dominant. They bundle, what, hundreds or thousands of transactions into one little piece of data that gets posted back to the secure layer one. How much does that actually save the user?
I mean, it's a total game changer. That single batch gets verified by L1, and the gas fee for that one verification gets split among everybody in the batch. So you're looking at cost reductions of like 10x to 100x.
Wow.
But this is where it gets a bit nuanced, because not all rollups work the same way.
Right. There are two main flavors. Let's start with optimistic rollups. So Arbitrum Optimism.
So optimistic rollups, they basically run on an honor system.
Yeah.
They process a batch of transactions and just assume it's valid by default. That's the optimistic part.
So what's the safety net?
The safety net is a challenge period, which is usually about 7 days. During that week, anyone can look at the batch, and if they see something wrong, they can submit a fraud proof. If they're right, the bad transaction gets reverted, and the person who posted it gets heavily penalized, slashed.
So it relies on game theory, the idea that it's just not worth it to cheat, because you'll get caught and lose a ton of money.
Exactly. It works. But it does have one big user experience drawback. If you want to withdraw your money from an optimistic rollup back to L1, you have to wait for that 7-day challenge window to close.
That makes sense. Okay, so contrast that with the other big type, ZK rollups or zero knowledge rollups. These sound way more complicated.
They are, mathematically. But many people think they're the true long-term solution.
Mm-hmm.
ZK rollups don't use an honor system. They use some really advanced cryptography called validity proofs.
Okay.
So instead of waiting for someone to find a mistake, they generate a complex mathematical proof that proves the entire batch of transactions is correct before they even post it to L1.
So the L1 doesn't have to recheck all the individual transactions, it just checks the proof.
Precisely. And if the proof is valid, which is a very quick check, the transactions are final, instantly. The math can't lie. So you get rid of that 7-day waiting period.
This brings up a huge point then. Security inheritance. Yeah. How can we trust these L2s if they're separate?
This is the most important concept to get about modular architecture. A true L2 inherits the security of its L1. That's what makes them fundamentally safer than, say, a sidechain, which has its own separate set of validators that could be much less secure.
So if I'm on an L2 and for some reason the L2 operator goes rogue or their server just fails, my money isn't stuck there forever.
No, and that is the absolute genius of it. Mm-hmm. You can always go to the L1, the Supreme Court, and force exit your funds directly from the L2's smart contract. The L1 is always the final arbiter of truth.
Okay, shifting gears just a little bit, but staying in the engine room, let's talk about the machine that actually drives the L1, the Ethereum virtual machine, the EVM.
Right. This is what makes Ethereum so much more than just a ledger for money.
It's not just a calculator.
Not at all. If Bitcoin is a decentralized calculator, the EVM is a decentralized global computer. It's a system that can run any kind of code you give it through smart contracts. And with every block, it executes these contracts and moves the entire network state forward.
And the fee for using that global computer is gas. I think most people just see gas as this annoying, expensive fee. But it actually has a critical dual purpose.
It absolutely does. And you have to understand it to use DeFi. Gas is the fee you pay validators to do computational work. It does two things. First, it pays them to secure the network. But second, and this is crucial, it prevents spam. By making every single operation cost something, it makes things like infinite loops or denial of service attacks incredibly expensive to run.
And the cost changes depending on what you're doing, right? A simple transfer is cheap, but a complex DeFi trade is more expensive.
Exactly. I mean, I remember back in the NFT craze of 2021, you'd pay hundreds of dollars in gas just for your transaction to fail. That kind of chaos is what forced the big change to how gas works.
Let's talk about that. EIP-1559, it really changed the game. Before that, it was just a chaotic auction, right?
A total mess. You just had to guess what price to bid to get your transaction included. EIP-1559 made it algorithmic. Now, every block has a base fee that goes up or down automatically based on how busy the network is.
So if the network is clogged, the base fee goes way up to discourage usage.
Precisely. And that base fee gets burned, which is a whole other economic discussion. Then on top of that, you have the priority fee, which is basically a small optional tip you give to the validator to get them to include your transaction faster.
Okay, that makes it much clearer. So when you see the terms gas units and gas price, how do they fit into this new system?
The gas units are fixed. That's the amount of work a certain action takes. A simple transfer always costs 21,000 units. The gas price is what you pay for each of those units. And that price is now made up of the base fee plus whatever priority fee you added.
So the total cost is still gas units times gas price, but the whole system is just much more predictable now.
Way more predictable, even if it can still get expensive when things are really busy.
All right, we have covered a lot of ground, from the high-level trilemma down to the nuts and bolts of gas fees. Let's try to synthesize this. What are the key takeaways for someone trying to navigate all this?
I think there are three things. First, the trilemma is real. And it's a universal constraint. Every chain you use is made a sacrifice somewhere.
Okay.
Second, layer twos are the answer to scaling. And the key is that they inherit their security from the L1. That's what makes them trustworthy. And third, understanding gas economics tells you when and where it makes sense to transact.
So practically speaking for a user, what does that mean? When should I use L1 versus an L2?
It's pretty simple now. For 99% of your daily activity swapping tokens using DeFi apps, minting most NFTs, you should be on an L2. It's cheaper, it's faster, it's a better experience.
An L1.
You reserve the L1, the Supreme Court, for really high value stuff, settling a massive transaction, moving a corporate treasury, things where you need the absolute maximum security and you're willing to pay for it and wait for it.
It's interesting the complexity is shifting, isn't it? It's less about the base layer and more about the connections between the layers.
It is, and that brings up a really important warning. We say L2s inherit L1 security, which is true. But the process of moving your money between L1 and L2, which is called bridging, that can be a major point of failure.
Bridge risk is a huge topic.
It's very real. Many of the biggest hacks have been on bridges. So you have to be careful and use the official, well-audited bridges when you move your assets.
That's a very practical, very urgent piece of advice.
Keep it in mind.
So To leave everyone with a final thought to chew on, if we accept this modular future where the L1 just becomes the Supreme Court for settlement and all the actual user activity moves to these faster L2s, where does the power really end up? If all the economic action is happening on the execution layer, what new kind of trust or maybe even centralization are we creating in that high-speed environment?
Something to think about. Keep digging deep.
We'll see you next time.